the things that we do on our local sites have an impact, not just to us, but to many other people.
I'm very passionate about the fact that woodland owners need options, and it can't be just about selling timber.
When you're putting out pollinator habitat, you're not just supporting pollinators. You're going to be supporting lots of different wildlife species.
As agriculture evolves and changes, are we, making sure that we are conserving our natural resources well, and are we, planning on preserving those?
Hey, welcome to Our Rich Land, a podcast of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District and Kingwood Center Gardens, where we explore what it means to improve, protect, and conserve our natural world. I am Evan Stern. I am a technician with Richland Soil and Water, and
Josh Steffen, Executive Director at Kingwood Center Gardens. In this episode, we are diving into the wonderful world, and I mean wonderful world, of stormwater management. What is stormwater management, you ask? Well, we're going to try to explain that by talking about the Gateway Project recently completed, and by recently, I mean in the last year, at Kingwood Center Gardens, which is the focus of the first half of the episode. Mm-hmm. And whenever we reference the project, in quotes here on my script, that is what we are talking about. Okay?
So just really briefly, so everybody has an idea of what the Gateway Project is.
Yes.
It wasn't just stormwater stuff, right?
No, so the Gateway Project was the first phase of our 2015 master plan, where we created a single point of entrance and parking and orientation for visitors through our Trimble Gate, and yeah. And then which involved a parking lot, visitor center, that kind of thing.
And stormwater, for those of you who are new to the concept, is basically the runoff that results from rain or snowmelt, and that water has to go somewhere. Hence our storm drains. And it's also often really dirty, so it needs to be cleaned. And it's also often a lot, so it needs to be controlled before it overwhelms our drain systems. So this is what best management practices are for, but we'll get to all of that. And we brought on two guests today, and I'm going to briefly talk about the first one.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk to him. It's going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be great. They're both named Mark, so that's confusing.
Yeah.
So if you get lost, we're sorry.
We're not providing directions back.
So one of the principal engineers who worked on the Gateway Project, his name is Mark Roofner. He works for K.E. McCartney, which is an engineering firm in town. And then we'll explain what these mean later, but he is a CPESC and a CPSWQ. That has to do with stormwater certification.
So. But however, we also brought in another world-renowned expert, Mark Hoover, who is our director of horticulture at Kingwood Center Gardens. And he is awesome. On this particular project, he was a key participant in terms of helping plant selection, mm-hmm. Helping to looking at the engineered soils that were brought in to raise and change grades and elevations and gotcha. All that kind of fun stuff.
Okay. Cool.
Mark Roofner worked closely with Mark Hoover and the rest of the project team to pull that all off.
Nice. And then in the second part of this episode, we'll draw some parallels between the Gateway Project and stormwater BMPs, which are best management practices. And then kind of shrink it down to the homeowner scale and how they can manage runoff on their own properties.
Yeah, because the good thing with anything, if you can distill thing, to the basic principles, the parts and the pieces.
Yeah.
You can scale that up and down to whatever, whether it's a courtyard, an entire homeowner's property, a commercial or a very large scale campus type thing.
Yeah. Yeah, like
or regional projects.
Yeah, you distill it down to the basics of what are you trying to do?
Yep.
And then what's your goals?
Yep.
And then, yeah. Alrighty. On with the show.
Play some vaudeville.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, on with the show. Evan. everybody, for your information, Mark Ruffner is a professional engineer with 19 years of experience.
Morning, how you doing?
Could you tell us, Mark, what a CPESC and a CPSWQ is?
Sure. So CPESC is Certified Professional in Erosion and Sediment Control, and CPSWQ is Certified Professional in Stormwater Quality.
Okay, gotcha. And Mark is General Civil Services Manager for K.E. McCartney and Associates, which is a local engineering firm that's been here in the county for about 45 years.
And took the lead on our local new award-winning project here at Kingwood Center Gardens.
The Gateway Project.
The Gateway Project, yeah. That's right. And the other person we have here is?
Mark Hoover.
And he is?
I'm the Director of Horticulture at Kingwood.
And what was your role in the Gateway Project and the stormwater management here?
Leading all the horticultural aspects, so working with our director and horticulture team, choosing plant material and getting it installed. And
so I guess what was the design parameters for the project? What was the reason that we needed to better manage our stormwater? Like what existed here before? And kind of what was the approach taken with this project?
Sure. So historically at Kingwood Center, there's always been a pretty decent watershed coming down through the center of Kingwood. There is a pond at the northeast corner of the site. That pond has really not served any type of a stormwater management function in the past, per se. But as we are looking at developing the Gateway Project, there's a couple things that come into play. One, new regulations are requiring better stormwater management. But really, more importantly, as a public, as a whole, we've come to understand that stormwater plays a really important role in our environment. So we want to treat that stormwater in a way that makes it that cleans it up, especially as we add hard surfaces, we have more stormwater runoff. We want to take that runoff and treat it so that we're not discharging polluted stormwater into our streams and our lakes.
When you're adding hard, surfaces, what are we cleaning up? What's making the water so dirty? Making it gray water?
So in many cases, if you think about a parking lot, you might have leakage from your vehicles. That could be oil, things they pick up as they're traveling. You have sediment. That's definitely an issue. And we want to take really all of those pollutants and try to either remove them or minimize them before the water leaves the site. The other thing you have going on here is there is a small intermittent stream that runs through Kingwood Center. And historically, it was very channelized and it was largely piped.
What does channelized mean in layman's terms?
So basically, we take a stream and we restrict it. So it has a small width and really tight sides. So when water comes down through it, it flows through quickly, but it also has higher velocity. So it's moving faster. It's picking up sediment as well as it travels through that channelized section. And there's really no ability for it to treat or to even slow down on the site and have a chance to deposit some of that sediment it may have picked up in its
right.
travels.
Yeah. So that's one of the key things we'll talk about and highlight when you're dealing with your water on your property. The most important thing to do is slow water down in lots of different ways. Traditional drainage was basically straight shooting water through the property through channels, and it just moves too quickly. If you ever watch your water, how does water naturally flow across the surface? So if you just look at water coming down at your windshield, does it drop straight? No, especially unless there's a certain weight to it, gravity wise, it naturally curves. Water will just does. There's something about the property of water and surfaces where it will curve. It will serpentine its way down, and so natural stream beds do the exact same thing. They follow the same natural pattern of this kind of back and forth snake-like effect. So the more you can design your systems with some of those kinds of aspects involved, you're slowing the water down, you're actually working with the natural patterns of the properties of water rather than straight channeling it down.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all good things and principles to slow the water down so it has time to settle out, all those types of things.
Right.
So, yeah, I was, our office did a tour with you guys last year, kind of looking at how this project played out. But I guess, Mark, what kind of stormwater BMPs, which is short for best management practices, I guess, first of all, what is a stormwater BMP? And then secondly, what kind of BMPs were you looking at here when you first saw the site and looked at the design?
And to add on to that, to Mark Hoover's, how we want to get to how does the plant material play an integral role,
right,
in the design of a good stormwater practice?
So Mark first.
Sure.
so which Mark? So we'll start with Mark Hoover with best practices. Or Rifner. So there's too many Marks in the room.
No problem. So the best management practice is really a term that EPA has formulated, and it's basically means a practice that is used to improve your stormwater runoff, the quality of your stormwater runoff. And that can be many different things. We'll talk about three specific ones here at Kingwood Center Gardens that were utilized, but there are many others as well. The first one, we've talked a little bit about the stream already. One of the goals that we had was to take that small stream and reconnect it to its floodplain. So as was mentioned, when water runs off, it runs in a curvilinear motion. And if you look at natural streams, there is the ability for the water as you have runoff, it fills up the stream and then it overflows and spreads out. And those side areas are really where you get deposition of your sediment. So part of what we did was we daylighted more of the stream, we widened it so it's not moving as quickly, and then we created areas where as the stream starts to fill up, it spills over its banks and spreads out. And that's actually visible right in the visitor area. There's a small bridge that goes over that stream, and you can see how the stream has been spread out.
Yeah.
And this is the boardwalk coming right outside the Gateway Visitor Center as you're going into the garden.
Correct. Yeah. So that's one best management practice. Sorry, go ahead if you had questions.
Well, I just wanted to define what you meant by daylighted real quick.
So a lot of the system was piped in the past, and much of it still needed to be piped, but where possible, we removed that pipe so that now the channel has access to daylight as opposed to being in a pipe.
That pipe previously, went underneath the perennial garden, the old perennial garden. So we opened that up.
Right. You think a natural stream channel has a lot of another typical practice, like we're using riprap and stuff. The sides of the channel affects the velocity of the water. So if the surface area, so you treat it with grass, with there's different coefficients of friction that help to, that the engineers have to determine that. And so a solid pipe is this flat, hard surface that moves the water really quickly. So that's why piping isn't necessarily always the best option, if you can daylight it. And then if you can add curves to it, if you can make the surface more rough, all of these things is going to slow that water down.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to make sure you don't slow it down too much. Then you got more problems.
Okay, you might be a little confused with some of the terms we used in the past couple minutes.
That probably doesn't happen.
Mark Rufner said something about EPA. He's referring to the Ohio EPA, which is the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency. I better look up Ohio EPA just real quick so that I don't say anything dumb and not true.
What's the fun in that?
The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency is the administrative department of the Ohio state government responsible for protecting the environment and public health by ensuring compliance with environmental laws. There it is. Okay.
So yeah, I talked about riprap, right?
Yeah. What is that?
Yeah, it's not what I just did. It is, we've all seen it. It's usually large chunks, well, differing sizes, usually of broken up used concrete that, it, you know, so stone type material, usually, you know, used to line various slopes to slow down water. Again, another way of slowing down water by changing the surface treatment, whether, you know, like we were just talking, different surfaces have different, the smoother it is, the faster water flows, the rougher the water or the rougher the surface, you know, the slower it goes. So you put a bunch of riprap on that and it slows the water down and prevents it from taking soil with it and taking and creating erosion.
So it's kind of like sledding down a hill in winter that has really slick snow,
right,
or like trying to sled on a gravel hill.
So what's the coefficient of friction? That's a direct, really, you know, connects to the riprap. So some engineer somewhere, you know, ran tests with different types of surface treatments, grass,
gotcha,
hard, you know, concrete, bare soil, rock, like riprap, and the water flows at different velocities, you know, if you're holding, you know, slope constant,
yeah,
obviously water will flow over that surface at different speeds. The faster water flows, the more likely it is to pick up particulate matter like soil. So bare soil is not the world's greatest usually up because it leads to, that's one reason why around, at least in our part of the country, ditches and ditch commissions are often paying for, you know, backhoes to come in and clear out ditches every once in a while along mm-hmm. fields because the grass has gotten too thick.
Yeah.
Or trees and other plant material have gotten in there and have slowed down the water too much. And therefore it doesn't slide off fast enough.
So that would equal a high coefficient of friction?
Right. The bare, well, in comparison, bare soil versus grass.
Bare soil is low.
Right.
Okay. So the higher the coefficient of friction, the more.
I believe so.
That the water is hitting stuff on its
That's
way.
That's right. That's right. The more friction, the slower it goes.
So one thing to note there related to that stream, property owners, if they are interested in doing something with a stream on their property, there are permits that are required. So just be aware of that. You don't want to go in and relocate a stream without getting appropriate permits. That's not something you'd want to do just willy-nilly.
And why is that? Why is there a regulation in place to have that checked against, shall we say, outside authority?
Sure. So really the purpose goes back to the Clean Water Act with the federal government. The federal government gave US EPA and then in conjunction with US EPA, the state EPAs, the authority to regulate water throughout the states and ensure that individuals were not performing work that was going to provide a negative impact to streams and lakes and to the waters of the state is what they call it. So that regulation was really put into effect to ensure that the type of work that was done does not create a negative impact, or it minimizes the negative impact. We need pipes, right? There are times when we have to pipe a stream, but they limit the amount you can pipe, and they basically make sure that what's happening is not creating a major negative impact.
And if you don't know what you're doing, you could easily, by relocating or how you design your channel, you know, you're just taking a backhoe and then you just start digging trenches, you know, it
right,
it could cause problems,
yeah,
shall we say.
Easily could cause problems.
So what was the third best practice that you used here?
Well, actually, let's talk about the second one. It may have sounded like there were a couple in there, but for the parking lot for the new Gateway Center and the rooftop as well, we designed what we call bioretention areas, and I'm going to refer to them as rain gardens from here on out. It's a more common term.
Let's call them bioswales, just to separate them from our rain garden that we have here. They do a lot of the same function.
Yeah, sure. We can call them bioswales. So they are a practice that is put in place really to capture runoff and to filter out the pollutants that come from that runoff. So, and the more you can do at the upper end of your watershed, the better. So we want to capture that runoff as quickly as we can.
So that highlights, I would say, the second principle where I'm kind of interjecting design principles that kind of apply at any scale. And that's, I was taught to capture water as quickly and high on the land and store it high on the land as possible.
Yes.
So that it's slowing it down. So that's what you did here.
Correct. Yeah. So water runs off of the parking lot into these bioswales, and the bioswales are designed with a couple different things. First of all, there's a storage area, so water can pond in those bioswales, and then there is also soil that is designed to filter that water. So the water will quickly then filter down through that soil before it leaves the bioswale. The third component of that is the plantings. The more natural plantings you can get that have deep root systems,
right,
the better off you are, the more capture that water you can get. So with that runoff, as much as possible, we want to capture it and actually keep it from leaving the site.
Right.
We can keep it from leaving the site. It stays on site, whether it's through infiltration into the ground or through the plant capture as well. We can't capture all of it. Some will run off. And then we have a third practice, which is the detention basin, the pond at the end of the system that controls the rate of runoff or the rate of discharge from the entire site.
And how is that engineered? How is that controlled?
So there's an outlet structure that basically is designed to control the runoff. There are calculations that really are standard in Ohio. We call it the critical storm method that basically looks at your pre-development runoff. So that would be the runoff prior to putting our hard surfaces in place, our parking lots, our rooftops. And then we look at the runoff after we put in those hard surfaces, and we design the system so that we only release to those pre-development rates.
Hold on. What is an outlet structure?
An outlet structure?
Yes, what is it?
Are we doing this?
Is it something in the wall?
No, it's not. An outlet structure, see, like we were talking about, you guys have a big detention pond at the end of your system.
It's true.
And there is, I think I've seen it too, there's a big concrete box at one side.
We have an outlet structure there, yes.
Yes.
It's a big stinking piece of concrete box that's been, you know, that allows engineered to collect and allow certain amounts of rates of water out, so to speak.
Which I think has some things to do with the Ohio EPA, because they have certain regulations on, you know, how water is outletted and
right.
How
I
much
mean,
can
the,
be.
You don't want it to outlet too fast, because it helps to control flooding.
Right.
It helps control eroding to natural streams.
I saw an example that kind of relates to this. My wife and I were recently down in West Virginia for a vacation, and we were at the Gauley River. The Summersville Reservoir has one of the largest earthen dams in the U.S.
Yeah, dam would be huge. I would consider an engineered outlet structure.
Pretty much. Yeah. And they originally put it on there because, for one reason or another, the Gauley River was, you know, having terrible floods. So they wanted to put a structure in the river to help with the water quality.
Or it was flooding like it always did, and then humans decided to put a house in a spot where it was naturally doing it, and then we don't like that anymore.
So that may be true.
It may be something to do with it.
I don't know exactly that history, but so that's outletting all the time, or else the downstream stream would
you'll get there
would dry up. Well, our Richland fans, if you dig this podcast, please share it with a friend.
Please. We don't really care why you share it, as long as you share it.
It means a lot, and it means we get to keep making episodes because more people listen to this podcast. So. True. Richland County Soil and Water Conservation District is an organization that seeks to educate and guide people towards their conservation goals and to be a leader in the stewardship of our county's natural resources. We are a public resource for all county residents and work to serve them in a lot of different ways. We administer our county's stormwater permitting program for residential, commercial, and agricultural building projects. In the unincorporated areas of Richland County and the Village of Lexington. We also administer several different agricultural and land management programs, hold seminars, assist with tree seedling and native plant sales, hold crafting workshops.
You mean you're not going to read word for word everything that's
hey,
in the
I can
bullet point there? That's true. That's true.
But I especially want to highlight our stormwater resources. So, like I said, we do the stormwater permit program. That can be done in person in our office or online. You can check out our website or call our office at 419-747-8686 for more information and help on that. We also have two staff members who are very knowledgeable in rain gardens and rain barrels specifically and usually hold several workshops for those during the year. You can check out our calendar of events on our website at www.richlandswcd.net for those events. Our website will also be linked in the show notes.
I just think it's cute that you still say www.
www.
No one does that anymore, man. Okay. We're way beyond that. We've evolved.
We've evolved.
We're so much more sophisticated.
All right, fine. www.richlandswcd.net.
Works for me.
That's the Gen Z version.
Yo, yo. Yeah, Kingwood Center Gardens, we exist to promote deep connections between people and the land, each other, and also that, you know, human and natural communities can thrive. That's our bottom line deal. We do it through creating positive, transformative guest experiences within this historic garden estate that Mr. King set up. He graciously planned and provided our founding, you know, seed money and support, and we continue to rely upon that all, as well as the generous contributions and people and patronage of those who provide it, so that we can then turn around and provide back things that people are really deeply seeking, which is a opportunities to get away from it all and find inspiration in nature and beauty, just basic simple stuff that we all need to recharge, especially in this day and age.
Nice.
You can find out all of our events and classes as well as what's going on at the garden at kingwoodcenter.org. That's kingwoodcenter.org. And there's lots of stuff, you know, always going on there all the time.
Sweet.
Mark, with the bioswale, Mark Hoover. With a bioswale or bioretention or whatever the heck you want to call it. And a swale is basically a ditch on contour, meaning the bottom of the ditch is got the same elevation all the way across. A ditch is designed to drain water off because every foot you move down the trench, it's at a different height. But a swale has pretty much the same elevations across, so that it slows the water down and it doesn't have that same draining effect. It has a different purpose. What with the plant material, how does that interact with, you know, appropriate plant material that you would want to put? What kind of plant characteristics should a person think about when they're selecting plant material that's going to go into a rain garden or a bio retention swale thing?
Well, soil is first. You got to start with soil, and it's critical. Like these bio what I would call ditches, but it's more of a sandy mix. So the, you know, plant material has to have, you know, deep rooted, like Mark said, but they have to be able to handle those inundations of water, you know, in the flooding periods. And then as that soil dries out, they've got to withstand more of that drought period as well, which, hence the deep roots, which also helps collect and filter out some of that sediment and pollutants, you know, from parking lot or wherever else the water, you know, is running off from.
Okay. So one of the, their plants kind of fall into different habitat classifications. There's things that are called obligate wetland plants. That means they have to have their roots in water all the time. Think cattail, or they'll die. And then there are plants that are called facultative, meaning they're good either way. So it sounds like the kinds of plants that you would want to put into a bioswale where there's, you have that extreme seasonal swing between super wet for short periods and then could be super dry for long periods. You want plants that can handle those extremes. You wouldn't want to stick a cactus down in the middle of the swale. You want to add anything else to that?
No, I think, you know, it's always going to fluctuate depending on your site, you know. Here at Kingwood in the parking lot, for example, those beds drain pretty darn well, where they, you know, they may hold water in a heavy rain, you know, up to 24 hours, but it's never longer than that. And nor do you necessarily want that, but it, you know, different areas, different soils, they're going to drain differently. So it's right plant, right place.
So speaking of soil, let's say the homeowner is dealing with, you know, they don't have the option of getting engineered soils in. They have to work with what they got, and it's heavy clay. Either Mark, you want to speak to how you would approach a bioretention or a rain garden situation where the soil has a very slow percolation rate.
So in the bioswales, we were dealing with heavy clay soils as we deal with in much of Ohio. And basically what we do is design an underdrain system that anything that can't infiltrate into the ground can be taken up by that underdrain system and then discharged to the pond, the stormwater management facility at the end of the site.
So like your typical corrugated black, you know, perforated pipe that you might use in a farm, that people are familiar with in farm fields around here.
Yes, and there's a couple things you can do with that. In the past, many times those systems were designed to just drain straight to the storm sewer. Now, a lot of times what we'll do is actually run the under drain through the system, upturn the elbow, and raise that drain up so that there's always a level of water in the bottom of that bioswale, and that's an anaerobic area where bacteria can work.
And that's, you're saying that's a bad thing or a good thing?
That's a good thing. Yeah. So the bacteria can work, help take out some of the pollutants, and it allows more water to infiltrate.
Okay, last question to Mark Hoover. Your favorite plants to put into a rain garden situation?
Lobelia cardinalis.
Which is what?
Cardinal flower.
Native or non-native?
Native.
What do you like about it?
Beautiful red flower.
What time of year? July-ish, right?
Sure.
Yeah, that's what you're saying, yeah. Pollinator friendly?
Oh, absolutely. Hummingbirds. Hummingbirds galore.
There you have it from an official source, folks. Anything else you want to add, Mark, before I release Mark Hoover? Before I release you to your own devices. It's been wonderful. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mark.
Get out of here. Go do something fun. Now back to you, Ruffner.
Okay.
I want to kind of come back to your, at a high level, talk about your calculations, like how, because I want to be able to share with the homeowner how they could do the same basic approach to, you know, first defining your watershed, what the heck that is for you, calculating pre-work or pre-construction, how did you do it, how would maybe a homeowner do it, and then And then how do you measure that afterwards? Ready, go.
Yeah, so I think for a homeowner, the process is a lot simpler. Most homeowners aren't really required to do a pre versus post calculation, but it is important to understand what is draining to the area where if you want to create a rain garden, that you understand what's draining to that area. And there's a lot of good information out there online on actually going through and designing a rain garden. You want the rain garden to be, you know, below some type of a drainage area. Maybe that is your driveway where water can drain down to the garden, or maybe that is a downspout or a couple of downspouts that drain down to the garden. And if you've got downspouts, you can quickly calculate, even on Google Earth, how much area of rooftop you would have getting to those downspouts and going to your garden. And that drainage area then determines how big you should make your rain garden. I don't have the exact calcs in front of me, but like I said, there's a lot of good information online that would actually walk a homeowner right through the process of sizing the rain garden, how you dig out your area, what kind of soils to use, what kind of plants to use.
We'll talk maybe through that, but the basic process, it sounds like, it sounds like you did with this project, you determine what your square, you know, footage or, you know, acreage, and probably in this case, that defines your watershed. Then you got to determine approximately how much water that whole surface area is collecting. And where it drains to, it could be a lot. It's surprising how much, you know, what kind of rain event, you know, you're calculating to. Mark, what do you typically, for this project, what did you determine as your kind of rain event, that you're 100-year, 1,000-year? What did you use?
A million year. No, just kidding. So we actually do a design that would incorporate in a 1-year design storm, mm-hmm, all the way up through a 100-year design storm. Okay. So we're looking at a range of storm events, but the 100-year storm event really is what controls that peak discharge from Kingwood Center Gardens.
The max that system has to be able to do.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
When you're looking at a rain garden, you're looking for a much smaller storm event. Mm-hmm.
It would
be even less than a 1-year typically.
So very quickly, can you tell us or define, or Evan, you wanted to define for the audience what do we mean by a rain event? We talk about these 100-year, you know, 50-year, 1-year. What does that really mean? It doesn't mean that, you know, this is going to happen once every 50 years. What does it really mean?
It's really more a percent, like a likelihood of occurring.
Yeah.
So a 1-year rain event would be an event that's likely to occur once per year. In reality, that rain event could happen multiple times per year, or we may not get it for 3 or 4 or 5 years. But the likelihood is that we'll have it will happen once per year. And that would be like somewhere around 2.5 inches of rain in a 24 hour period.
Yeah.
And whereas like a 100-year rainfall event would be over 5.5 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. So based on historical data, we would expect a 100-year event to only happen once every 100 years, or there's a 1% chance of that rain event occurring every year.
Right.
Okay.
It's another way to look at it.
Gotcha. So once you know your watershed, where do soil characteristics in your design, did you guys have to get percolation numbers and those kind of things to get a sense of how it get filters into the groundwater, into the soil, and then from there?
Right. We did not end up needing to get percolation numbers. We do have good soils information throughout the state that we can utilize. But looking at the soils themselves, we quickly realized that really to try to use a percolation rate wasn't feasible. Mm. So that is where the underdrain design came into play. So that we allow as much percolation as we can get, but we're not counting on that in our design. We're actually counting on the under drain to ensure that we are able to release all the water that we need to release.
Yeah. So to translate that, if your soils don't naturally incorporate your largest rain event, which is in case the 100 year. They don't naturally allow it to percolate through within the time frame that's acceptable. You're going to need to engineer in additional ability to drain that off. That's kind of what you had to do.
And for a homeowner, when you're actually looking at, you know, a small rain garden, typically you're not going to have under drains. You're going to have an area where the water drains down to the rain garden. It fills it up. At some point in a larger rain event, it's just going to spill over and continue on the path that it would have had before you put the rain garden in. Mm-hmm. And then when it stops raining, that water is going to slowly percolate into the ground, whatever was left there in your rain garden depression. And the plantings definitely help, right? Good plantings, native plantings, they're going to create better percolation rates, and they're also going to pull the water out of that depression quicker.
Right. So
you might have water sitting there still for, depending on your soils, you could have water still sitting there for a day or two, and that's not necessarily a problem.
If you got all the right parts and pieces in there correctly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Anything else you want to cover?
So real quick.
Go ahead.
OSU Extension has a rain garden guideline. They say for Southwest Ohio, but really it applies for other areas as well. I know Northeast Ohio also has a rain garden manual, and that really gives a lot of detail. Someone wants to build a rain garden, how to select the location, what kind of infiltration you might get. It really tells you all the steps. Yeah. That's what I would recommend a homeowner do. Start looking at one of those guides if they're interested in a rain garden.
I would also add to that, especially for local homeowners, our office is also a good resource for that. We have two staff that have been trained by that Northeast Ohio rain garden. It's a type of class where you go through and you actually get to practice it at the end. You get to design and build your own rain garden. Jordan and Dan from our office both did that, and they also do frequent rain garden workshops that have been pretty popular as of late. Yeah. So we have the technical experience in our office to also assist with that if people want information on how to do a rain garden in there.
Yeah. And Kingwood's a great place to come see demonstrations of all of these types of things too, of course.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk briefly for both of you, since you both are kind of involved at the, we'll say, global level at the larger scale projects, and how water conservation is being practiced and watershed management at the larger, you know, than homeowner site kind of thing?
Well, we talked about a small watershed on a local site, but really there are vast watersheds. Mm-hmm. You think of some of our larger streams and rivers locally. We have the Clear Fork, the Black Fork, the Rocky Fork are all more major streams or rivers, we might say, that feed eventually down to the Ohio River. So the things that we do on our local sites have an impact, not just mm-hmm. to us, but to many other people. If we're doing small things to improve our stormwater runoff, it's going to help the watershed as a whole. Same time, if we're doing things that negatively impact our runoff, it also impacts the watershed as a whole.
And watersheds is a concept as much as it is a practical reality. You know, you can define a watershed at any level, depending on your property lines. I mean, the Mississippi watershed is pretty much all of, you know, the Ohio watershed is a part of the Mississippi watershed, which is, you know, blah, 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 blah. It all feeds down to New Orleans, you know? And so you can, these watersheds are nested inside of, you know, bigger or smaller, you know, like a telescope. It's the homeowner watershed is just a part of, you know, the Kingwood watershed is part of the Toby Run. Toby Run is a part of the, I don't know, whatever it is.
Probably Black Rocky Fork, maybe.
Oh, Rocky Fork.
Rocky Fork. Yeah. And Rocky Fork and all these forks go into what? Ohio?
Mohican River.
Mohican.
Mohican.
Which goes to another river, eventually to the Ohio River.
Muskingum, yeah, I think.
My last job, the Botanic Garden, Wellfield Botanic Garden, was, Christiana Creek that fed into the St. Joe, River, then, which is part of where the name South Bend comes from, is the South Bend. It actually turns at South Bend and turns and goes back north. It's really weird. And goes into Lake Michigan. So
okay.
That's actually all part, where I was at is actually part of the Great Lakes watershed. And yeah, you didn't have to go very far. And you even see signs on the internet sometimes, right? You'll see you're entering X watershed, right? The Continental Divide. And yeah, that's a big watershed demarker, right, kind of thing.
Which there's one transversing the cross, yep, across 70, northern county.
Isn't there one on 71, 77, one of those two?
There might be. I think it
I know there's one that of those, and you'll say you're going, yeah, you're into the Ohio or the Mississippi watershed or whatever.
There's not much that goes into the Great Lakes system, but...
up around Cleveland it does, but...
Well, I mean, there's a strip of Richland, yeah, County that goes,
oh, okay,
up... to the Lake Erie Basin, so.
Isn't that crazy? And it's just fun to think about where, if you take a water droplet or eyedropper and you drop the water, where is that drop of water going, right? If it doesn't get evaporate, but where does it ultimately end up? Does it end up out in the Atlantic, through the St. Lawrence Seaway, or does it end up in the Gulf through the Mississippi watershed? It's one of those two options in here in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So, Mark, we appreciate your time. And,
all right, thank you.
Yeah.
You have a good one.
You too.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. Yep. We appreciate it.
Goodbye.
So for this segment here, we have Dan Harold. He is one of our technicians who deals with the stormwater program, but is mainly focused on what is called the MS4 program, and we'll get to what that means in a second. This episode, we listened to Mark Ruffner talk about the different BMPs at Kingwood's Gateway Project and those best management practices. Dan sees almost on a day-to-day basis when he's doing commercial inspections for our commercial stormwater applicants. So, first of all, welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
Could you just quickly explain what you do when you go out and you do commercial inspections?
So our main concern is, we want to go out and make sure that there's no sediment getting tracked off site or leaving the site, and erosion is being kept to a minimum. And there are many, as Evan was saying, best management practices that can be used to slow or stop those things from occurring.
Gotcha. So, and you're looking for those best management practices on the site because they should have been included in like the SWIP plans, which are another name for the commercial stormwater projects. But SWIP stands for, I believe, Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan.
You got it.
And through our county's stormwater regulations, contractors and property owners are supposed to have specific things on those SWIP plans. Can you explain a little bit what that all entails?
Well, there's a long list of requirements that the engineers for the projects have to meet to show how water is going to be handled, how erosion and sediment is going to be handled, the calculations for all of those things. So if they have any type of post-construction BMP or best management practice, such as a detention or retention area, they have to show that those practices will hold the required amount of water coming from the site, as well as release it at the specified rate that Ohio EPA has set forth for this permit term.
Gotcha. Okay. And I've been out with Dan on a few of these commercial inspections, and I kind of think they're fun because it's like a treasure hunt, because you have a map with you, which is the SWIP plan. That's, and then you're supposed to, you walk around and you try to find the different BMPs
that are supposed to be there.
Right. Might not always be there.
Or installed properly.
Right. So we'll transition here into what MS4 is all about. Dan, could you explain the acronym and then how the SWIP plans and the inspections kind of tie into that?
Sure. So MS4, and one thing you'll find as we go through this is there will be a lot of acronyms that are used. The Ohio EPA loves acronyms. So you'll hear me refer to some of those. I'll try and explain what they are as we go. But MS4 stands for Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System. And what this means is that our storm sewers in Richland County are separate from the sanitary sewers. So you may ask, well, I don't have a sanitary sewer. I've got my own septic system. Yeah. And you're correct. So you're not in one of the, you may not be in one of the urban areas, so you may not have to deal with the sanitary sewers, but you still have storm sewers.
Gotcha. Okay. What all does the program consist of, and what do you do to fulfill? I know the program has specific requirements, and how do you fill that on a daily basis?
So I'm going to try and keep this as short as we can. It's a pretty long and in-depth process, but the MS4 program is part of the NPDES, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, that all come from the 1972 Clean Water Act. The separate requirements, we have to meet with four separate townships here in the county: Madison, Mifflin, Springfield, and Washington. Are in Richland County are listed in these six MCMs, or minimum control measures. As I said, acronyms are the big thing here. the first MCM is public education and outreach. The second one is public involvement and or participation. Number three is illicit discharge detection and elimination. Number four is construction site stormwater control. Number five is post-construction stormwater management in new development and redevelopment. And number six is pollution prevention, good housekeeping for municipal operations. Within those six MCMs, there is a large list of specifications, programs, and requirements Richland County must meet on a yearly basis to be in compliance with the Ohio EPA Environmental Protection Agency NPDES permit.
Are all six of those, do you have to do those, like, are they steps that you have to do in order, or are they just six things that you need to focus on? Because you kind of do all six all the time.
Yes, yeah. So yeah, there's no real rhyme or reason to it. There's just within each one of those six MCMs, there are requirements and programs that have to be completed every year to meet the or to be in compliance with the Ohio EPA. Some things have some of those MCMs have things that have to happen more often, like the construction site stormwater inspections that we have to do. Those have to be done monthly. But like on the public education and outreach, there are certain things that you can do, like working with, having workshops. We do rain barrel, rain garden workshops. If we have two of those a year two of those a year, we've met that one of those requirements. So it's just a matter of what it specifies in that minimum control measure or MCM that has to be done and how often it has to be done.
Okay, cool. Well, Dan, I appreciate your time in explaining all of this, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. we'll keep trying.
Keep trying. Our Rich Land is a production of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District in Kingman Center Gardens in Mansfield, Ohio.
If you want to impress your friends at your next party about all the cool stormwater management stuff that you have been, shall we say, dumped upon, here is some extra learning you can partake in from this episode. The Garden Gateway. There's a page on Kingwood's website. It's kind of an part of the interactive map. Click or tap to learn more and read about Kingwood's this particular capital project. The Northwest Ohio Master Rain Gardener. I'm reading your lines there.
It's fine.
No, I mean, I see an E. I try to stick to it.
We have linked a couple of specific rain garden resources in the show notes. One is the Northeast Ohio Rain Garden Manual, which Mark Rufner referred to earlier. This manual explains what a rain garden is and takes homeowners step by step through the process of developing one for themselves. We have a copy of this on our website, and we also have physical copies here in our office at Soil and Water. If you are an interested homeowner or business, we've also included a link for the Northeast Ohio Master Rain Gardener Certification Class, which is a 5-week in-person or online course that integrates classroom learning with getting your hands dirty. And you heard me right there. During this class, you will be building your very own rain garden by the end, so that's pretty cool. Like I said earlier, Richland Soil and Water has a lot of stormwater resources. I will be putting a plethora of links to our pages below. One additional thing I would like to mention, with our interview with Mark, we talked about a few different watersheds in the county, but we didn't get to all of them. So I will leave a link to our interactive watershed map in the show notes, where you can click through all 8 watersheds. Discover where the Continental Divide lies and find real-time water quality data, which we have a network of volunteers who live around the county that actually collect that data for us, and that is then put onto our website.
And just wait, that's not all. I know, there's more. I told you it's a dump. Here are a few other resources on stormwater here. Down below, linked in the thingamabob.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are more rated resources on stormwater, BPMs.
BMPs.
What? Did I get it right?
BMPs.
BM.
You said beats per minute.
Besides what we've just dumped upon you, there's even more resources on stormwater, BMPs.
All right. Should we end this?
Yes, please.